Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we break down the hardest-hitting social issues in sports. On today's show, the International Governing Body for Swimming made their decision regarding transgender athletes, and this controversial decision will have ramifications for the World Championships and the Olympics. My name is Chad Wiley, and with me, as always, is John Nekrasov. And John, how are you doing on this kind of dead sports week in terms of stories?
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. It's one of those weeks, even over at my actual job, where you're kind of like scrounging around to kind of find stories to run every so often. And it's just like it's a strange time for the sporting calendar, and as a result, for a sporting podcast. But we do have an issue to talk about today that will fill some airtime. But it's been weird, and you know, I have no sports to watch. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the last game I watched. I guess the Stanley Cup Finals are still going, so I've watched a little bit of that, but I don't have ESPN, so I haven't even watched that very closely.
Yeah, it's kind of a dead, the NBA's over, and then you get a little bit of hockey, and then it's kind of just baseball all the way through the summer. It should be a World Cup summer, and it's not, and so that's kind of frustrating.
I was just going to say, the fact that I know so much about what's going on in the world of golf demonstrates how little is going on in the sports world. I know that Fitzpatrick won the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
Like, and that Zalatoris almost won, but then didn't. Like, mm-hmm. The fact that I know that says a lot about where we're at currently in the sporting calendar.
Well, see, John, I was going to follow through on our commitment from last week to not talk about golf this week at all in the podcast, but you keep bringing it up.
Did we say that? I don't remember saying that.
Well, because we had done two straight weeks, and so we're like, I guess we're done with golf for the year. But then here you are. Maybe we've uncovered a secret interest of yours that's only going to continue to cultivate. Who knows?
I don't know. It's like maybe it's just like it's like a Stockholm syndrome thing. Like it's all you can talk about, and so then I end up like, oh, I actually love golf now.
Yeah, could be. John, I am interested in talking about this big story. We've talked about we did a podcast about transgender athletes in sports and tried to have a fairly nuanced conversation about that. And a lot of that ended up focusing on a current culture war topic in America is like high school sport. People talk about transgender issues at the local high school collegiate level. This is not a headline that impacts those things. This is about the International Governing Body for Elite Swimming and their decision. So this is like World Championships and Olympic level swimming. And I think their decision is fascinating. After having a research committee comprised of scientists, medics, medical professionals, and public policy professionals, they have decided to not allow transgender women who went through male puberty to compete in women's sports. That's kind of like the broad headline. There's a lot of specifics we can get into, but what's kind of your initial reaction to this decision, and did it surprise you?
Yeah, it's a huge decision, obviously. And so to clarify, this is a international body decision. So some time ago, the International Olympic Committee basically released some form of ruling that essentially said that they would not, basically giving guidelines for how to approach the issue of transgender athletes in an inclusive way, but basically left the actual decisions up to individual sports governing bodies to determine what they were going to do with the issue of transgender athletes. There have been at least a couple, I think. I know there was the power lifter who competed in the Olympics last year, I think. Mm-hmm. But there have not been a lot of transgender athletes who have competed in the Olympics as of yet. So this is still kind of a very much a developing issue. So this decision by the governing world body of international swimming is a decision that specifically basically covers all international swimming competitions, including the Olympics and swimming world championships. This is not a decision that impacts national swimming tournaments or collegiate swimming tournaments as of right now. So organizations like the U.S. swimming body will have to make its own decision based on this international decision on whether transgender athletes, people like Leah Thomas, who, you know, a lot of this conversation has kind of centered on since she competed in collegiate swimming and broke numerous records in women's swimming. So U.S. swimming will have to make its own decision, but this is very much a massive potentially precedent-setting decision by FINA.
Yeah, it is. It surprised me because I think that, you know, they certainly had more time that they could have deliberated on this. Like, I guess it seemed kind of sudden to me. Where, you know, we're, I guess, are we two years away from another Summer Olympics? Will it be 2024?
I think so, yeah.
So, they still had, you know, another year before even qualification for Olympics would start where they could deliberate this. I did read, you know, I looked at the types of groups that went into the research that FINA did, and it was a pretty diverse group of people out of Belarus, including, like I said, medical doctors and scientists, as well as, you know, public policy and human rights activists. So considering all the different factors of this decision, I think that talking about what it means for the Olympics, you know, and for the World Championships, it basically means that, like, Leah Thomas would not be able to compete, for example,
right,
as a woman in the Olympics is kind of the most prominent example. But one of the recommendations that they made, and one of the things that we talked about on our transgender podcast, the full one, is about the idea of making a competition genderless or having an open category. And one of the recommendations that FINA made was that you could have an open, non-specific event. And by doing that, you could allow just anyone to compete, because it is important to consider that, you know, figuring out where people can compete fairly is important. But it also, like, anyone should be able to compete in a sport in some regard and do so safely. And so figuring out where we can fit this complicated issue into both safety for and competitiveness for all the athletes, but also fairness for all people is going to be, I think, the ongoing conversation. But I wondered what you thought about the idea of an open category.
Yeah, I think they're obviously introducing this idea of a category as a way to potentially, you know, a lot of this conversation, there's a constant kind of, I guess, tension that most people discuss when addressing it, which is kind of this battle between inclusivity and fairness. And, you know, you asked earlier, like, am I surprised by this decision? And I'm not necessarily sure that I am. I'm a little bit surprised, I guess, that they came down so unilaterally on this and made such a clear cut decision. And I think the open, what's interesting is when you read, I guess, the opposing viewpoints on this issue. I've been trying to, you know, kind of read from statements by transgender advocates, basically, who've been discussing how they don't believe that this is an attack on the transgender community. And what's been interesting is the open category seems to be something that all opponents of this decision are kind of hitting on as something that doesn't make sense to them. And it seems like it, at least from the media opinions I've read, that it isn't a particularly popular idea. And I guess they're just asking, like, what's the point of even having it? Like, who's going to be competing in it? Will it be just like men and then transgender women who, you know, aren't allowed to compete in female sports? Like, will biological women even want to compete in an open category like that? So I think there's a lot of undetermined questions about that, you know, if male and female sports remain as is it like essentially sequestering transgender athletes into their own kind of category to compete against each other? Which transgender advocates would say that, you know, there are hardly any, as of right now, there are no elite swimmers who are transgender on the international level. So I think there's a lot of questions about whether that's just like a catch-all category to say that it's a solution while just barring them from competition. So I don't know, what do you think about that? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I think that if it became a common thing, I have some skepticism just about, like, thinking about who I think would actually, and this is just kind of my speculation, but who would be competing in this category. My assumption would be that it would be biological men who could not make the men's team. So not the world, like, second tier world-class men swimmers. Transgender women who transitioned after puberty. And then the only other instance where I could think would be like a biological woman who was, like, if she was dominating the women's category in her times, like, who wanted to prove that she could beat biological men. or transgender mm-hmm. women. And so, but again, that doesn't seem like a incredibly competitive or compelling group, other than just like
as kind of like it's not even particularly appealing. Yeah,
other than just as a scientific study of transgenderism and how just continued study of the competitive advantages. It doesn't seem like a very compelling event. I don't know, or appealing. So I am skeptical of that. But again, like, I don't necessarily have a better solution to propose either, which is why I'm at least open to it in the meantime.
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, there is, for example, recently, I think in an interview with Time magazine, Megan Rapinoe was asked, U.S. women's soccer star, was asked kind of about this issue just across the board of trans athletes, as you know, it's an issue that's come up in high schools, in college, now in professional stuff. She essentially said that in her mind, sports aren't the most important thing in the world, paraphrasing, aren't the most important thing in the world. All sports need to start with inclusion as their foundation, allowing, especially on the youth level, allowing everyone to compete as they want to. And beyond that, everything from fairness to winning trophies isn't as important as allowing everybody to play. And like, that is an argument that I've seen kind of come up regularly over the last week or so as I've been kind of reading opposing viewpoints. While the administrators of the sport are taking a very different view. What did you want to say?
Well, I thought just responding specifically to Rapinoe's comments, she said something that was kind of like, equality is more important than your girl's youth soccer team, mm-hmm. which is interesting, but also like we've talked about the fact that the U.S. women's national team got beat by an under 15 men's MLS team, and so mm-hmm. like I think that it's easy for her as a elite athlete to say that equality is more important than necessarily competitiveness in youth, and that may be true, but I don't, how open would she be to genderless or allowing biological men into her sport when that clearly doesn't seem to be that competitive either, is just a question that I would have.
Yeah, I think when you raise, that's an interesting point, and it kind of points us to the question of like, how do we even view like the idea of competition? And I think it's like, it's odd that she as an elite athlete would be trying to undermine the idea, like, as an elite athlete. She's like, I enjoy winning, but in the end, like, I would rather everyone be able to compete regardless of how they impact the sport. You know, like, there's been a constant argument with that both she's made and that I've seen other people make, that basically there are hardly any transgender athletes, and therefore this isn't an issue that should be addressed, is basically a direct argument that some people have made. Saying that, like, basically Leah Thomas's existence has made this an issue, even though there are no current actually elite transgender female swimmers on the international stage, that it's basically like a moral panic is what I've seen things described as. And I guess, like, on the one hand, I understand that, but I think we talked about it in the last episode we discussed on this, that I think it's largely a discussion based on principle rather than like a discussion that's just like, right now transgender athletes have taken over women's sports. I think the question is a question of whether it's fair for women's sports to be impacted in that way. And like, I've seen the argument also said that basically, like, if you argue for defending the right of biological women to compete in their sport against other biological women, that basically that it's like a cop-out almost, like you're just trying to fight against transgender women. And I feel like that's not really the myriads of women who are trying to fight for fair participation in women's sports and who have fought for years to create women's sports would seem to disagree with that. So I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of unfair arguments that are being leveled across the board right now.
Yeah, including some of like Leah Thomas's opponents and teammates who spoke anonymously to organizations right. like the Daily Wire talking about that. I think two things, I mean, we can move on, but two things that I just wanted to say. One, in regards to some of the backlash to this decision, one, according to CNN, one of the common talking points I've heard in the aftermath of this is people saying that there's not enough scientific research yet to indicate that there is a competitive advantage, but it seems like there is starting to be. And so I wonder if that kind of backlash and that particular objection is more so that the data is not coming out the way that they want it to come out. And so they're kind trying to get some more time, not to be cynical of their motives, but it does seem like the scientific consensus around advantages of athletes who go through male puberty is starting to become a more concrete scientific fact as opposed to just an mm-hmm. opinion. Like, the evidence is starting to become fairly overwhelming in that regard.
Right. And I think it's as a result, well, I think we'll see potentially, I think the impact of this is we'll see a lot more decisions like this happening in the future. For example, I believe the governing body of rugby sometime this week banned transgender women from competing in international rugby matches, mm-hmm. Which is kind of a big deal. And then Lord Coe, who is the president of World Athletics, has basically said that there is a high potential that they will be making a similar decision. And interestingly, is quoted as saying, but when push comes to shove, if it's a judgment between inclusion and fairness, we will always fall down on the side of fairness. That for me is non-negotiable. Basically directly saying that for them, the competition is what is important mm-hmm. here on the international level. And it's clear, it seems pretty clear that he most likely would line up. I don't know how exactly their decision-making process works, but that there's a strong potential that athletics will also go down the same road.
Yeah, my last point is political, and this is not something that I have a solution to, but it's just another aspect of this issue that I think we need to be considering politically, especially here in the United States, where there are states that are considering or proposing legislation that would basically criminalize or be child abuse to provide underage children with puberty blockers or hormonal therapy. And so in those kind of instances, based on this kind of ruling, for children who are required, either through like they live in a household where it's required or their state requires them to go through their biological hormonal puberty, that would mean that they mm-hmm. could never, if they truly end up transitioning and becoming transgender as an adult, that would mean that they could never compete in elite sports. And that's just something worth considering in regard to this right. particular decision. There are obviously a lot of other factors as well that go into allowing children to take hormonal therapy and puberty blockers. But again, it's an instance where the decision that we're making toward children, and especially because this decision has, based on this ruling, the decision has to be made as a child before they go through male puberty. Those decisions do have consequences that can affect those children for the rest of their lives, whether or not they do end up going into their adult life as their biological sex, gender, or as a different gender. And that's just worth, I think that's worth thinking about.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think that just further indicates how complicated the web of issues surrounding this issue is going to be and will continue to be, as you know, every different sport and governing body of sport, as well as you know, state and federal laws all kind of coincide. I think we're going to see a lot of confusion, quite honestly, over the next decade or so regarding how this issue is going to be confronted, and I don't think it's going to be resolved anytime soon.
No, certainly not. Certainly not in our political climate either.
No, most definitely not.
Let's talk a little bit of pop culture here at the end, John. We're going to kind of keep this podcast, you know, a little bit shorter, within 30, 40 minutes mm-hmm. instead of our usual
back
hour
to tradition.
Plus. But yeah, let's talk about Kenobi, which is over. I think that's kind
it
of
over.
The thing that we've been talking about and that is important right mm-hmm. now. I think that Kenobi stuck, I think everyone, we can all agree that Kenobi stuck the landing. And that the yes. episode 6 was definitively the best episode of the entire
By
series.
Far.
It
By
wasn't
far.
Really that close. How much that tilts you in terms of your love or hatred of the series as a whole is up to the people. But mm-hmm. Go ahead and give us there's a couple of specific things I want to note. But do you have any general overall thoughts about the episode before I note just a couple observations that I made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought. I know you liked the last episode. I didn't like it. Didn't really click that well for me, I guess. Like I generally enjoyed it. Episode 6, I genuinely did enjoy. I thought the Vader duel, the Vader Kenobi duel was great. I had a lot of fun with that. It felt like an old school, you know, like Star Wars comic book style battle. You know, I never really cared for Reva's arc, and I think we can get into that a little bit more. Her arc never really made sense to me, quite honestly. Just like the emotional beats of it never really like lined up for me in a way that I felt like, oh man, I'm really vibing with this. So that kind of, I still felt like that kind of took away from the episode a little bit, but I thought the show ended up doing a good job of tying up its loose ends. It felt like a Star Wars episode to me. Like it felt like it had a feel of solid Star Wars stuff. And you know, it wasn't like, it didn't make the show great for me, but it was an episode that I did not like have any problem seeing. And if someone is like, should I watch Kenobi? I was like, maybe you should just watch the Vader Kenobi duel, and I think you'll get most of what's good about the show. Because I genuinely loved it. It was so fun.
Yeah, I think the question that I was left with is, what do I make of a show where I only enjoyed about 45 minutes total of the actual screen time of a 6-episode show?
That's completely
valid. And then there were about 45 like really good minutes, and then about 4 hours of pretty eh.
Yep.
So that was one. Specifically about the finale, one of my observations was that it was just a very visually dark episode.
Like it was, for sure.
And I felt like, depending, for this to be a TV show, depending on your home entertainment setup, that could be quite like hard to watch even. There were parts of it that were just very, very, almost the whole finale was very dark. And so unless you have like the OLED true black TV or a really, really nice setup, it could honestly be like a little bit hard to watch, which leads me to my final point is going to be that this just should have been a movie, but we'll get there. I think one of the greatest problem of this TV show was that it was hard to make you buy into the stakes of the show because you knew what was going to happen to every single character before the show started. We knew what was going to happen to Owen and Beru. We knew what was going to happen to Luke and Leia. We knew what was going to happen to Obi-Wan. We knew what was going to happen to Vader. We knew what was going to happen to the Grand Inquisitor. All of those things were finished because we had seen them in future things in the timeline. The only things that like I believe could have happened was like, I guess they could have killed Bail Organa, maybe? I haven't seen all the Rebels stuff, but like maybe that wasn't a possibility. Would have been like a plot.
Isn't he mentioned in episode 4?
Maybe he is. Maybe if he's still alive in episode 4, then that's completely meaningless.
I'm pretty sure he's... Well, he's alive in Rogue One.
Oh, that's right. He's alive in Rogue One. Never mind. I guess like whatever they wanted to do with Reva, obviously. Like the reason why episode 6 didn't work for me either, it worked in part. Like the duel was really, really good. The Vader-Kenobi duel. I was right that, you know, we said, what does this need to stick the continuity angle? And I literally said, Kenobi needs to shred his mask in half. And that's what happens. That was cool. Mm-hmm. But they keep, in the middle of this duel, they keep cutting to this meaningless chase on the Tatooine desert of a boy that we know not only lives, but has no interactions with the Jedi prior to his turning 17. So not only do we know that he's going to live, we also know that he's going to have no idea what happened to him the entire time. Which is exactly what ends up happening. And people have said, well, other great duels have been interrupted by other things. Like, remember how in episode 6, the final duel between Vader and Luke keeps getting interrupted by the Ewoks. But at least the Ewoks are advancing the plot of Star Wars. Because there actually is a shield generator there that needs to go down in order Death Star to blow up.
Correct.
Nothing on Tatooine mattered.
That's objectively facts.
None of it. Zero. And so there's this thrilling and emotional and well-choreographed duel that has as much emotional heart as you could possibly have in Star Wars. And it keeps getting interrupted by literally meaningless content.
Which is this show summed up.
And I just had a problem with that. I guess I think it should have been a movie. I think that they could have trimmed at least an hour of the fat off of this movie, off of this show, or more, obviously, far more. They should have, Reva should have either died or disappeared at the end of episode 5. There was no reason for her to chase Luke, a boy, you know. Okay, let me, so like that scene at the end when she's carrying Luke and Owen and Beru are like, oh, what, is he dead? Like, everyone knows he's not dead. Like, why are you drawing out this emotional, like, why are we zooming in on Owen's face wondering if Luke is dead? He's Luke Skywalker. We know what happened. I don't know, man. That's what I have to say.
I don't know. Her arc was an attempt at bringing a different, like, bringing some jeopardy into the story, right? And that was the objective of the character, for sure. Because there wasn't really, there was young Leia, who obviously also can't die. And then just kind of some random throwaway characters, like whatever the girl's name was who died in the tunnels. I forgot.
Yeah, or Ice Cube Jr. playing Ronan.
Yeah, right. And he didn't die. He was fine. But, like, he could have died.
He was fine.
But, like, yeah, Reva was the attempt at trying to, like, add in a new character to the story. And it just didn't make sense to me. The, like, she's a youngling who's actually out for vengeance against Vader.
Right. And I'm mad at Anakin for killing children, so I'm going to go chase a child across the desert.
Like, because I'm going to go kill his kids. Like, it's like a revenge play, I guess.
Did Reva know that they were Vader's children?
I think that that had to have been. I didn't, like, pick up on it, but I'm sure that she had to have figured that out somehow. It would have made no sense otherwise.
How would that make? I guess that has to be the case, but I don't think that was ever actually, like, communicated.
It wasn't really communicated, and I just didn't figure it out. And then I was like, she's just trying to, like, get back at Vader, basically. I was like, that, okay. So, like, that wasn't even well communicated, right? Like, that you didn't even pick up on that. It literally took me to when she, like, dropped Luke off and left for me to figure, like, be like, oh, maybe that's why. I don't know. I just, like, if you're going to do, like, a revenge story like that, I feel like you can't, like, leave that up to a sudden, like, conversation twist in episode, like, 5. You know what I mean? Like, we see a conflict within her kind of the whole time, but it's not, like, we're never clued in to the fact that, like, there's an internal conflict about her not actually wanting to be murdering the populace of entire planets while she's murdering the populace of entire planets.
Or abetting Vader and snapping children's necks with the Force.
Right. Like, it doesn't make sense to me at all from just, like, an emotional character beat decision. Like, she's like, Obi-Wan's like, oh, you're here to fight Vader. And I'm like, okay, yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
So that didn't work for me. That just leaves us with, like, the Kenobi Vader beat, basically, as the only meaningful part of the show.
Yeah,
which I thought
duel,
was done fairly well.
The duel in episode 3, the last 15 minutes of episode 5, and then the duel in episode 6 are the only parts of the show that I will ever remember going forward. I enjoyed Ian McDiarmid's little cameo. I enjoyed...
He looks so old.
I enjoyed the Qui-Gon Jinn Liam Neeson cameo.
Just hearing his voice, honestly.
That wasn't exactly where I wanted that deployed. I was kind of hoping for, like, Obi-Wan is struggling in the duel and needs a little pep talk. Like, like, they could have done what they didn't do well with Rey in episode 9 when she's, like, getting beaten by Palpatine and then, like, every single voice in the history of the Jedi start talking to her.
Oh, like, I forgot about that.
It could have been a better version of that where, like, Obi-Wan needs a little pep talk to beat Vader, and so Qui-Gon is, like, there and, like, gives him some counsel and he goes and beats Vader. I don't know. That would have been better than, I think, just, like, having him there on the sands at the end as they go in their little Force adventure. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I don't know, man. This show just ended up disappointing me.
Was that because of our expectations?
I feel like they built up the expectations so high, though. I don't know if it was our fault. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess, should we have known that we were that it was going to be as predictable as it was, I guess? Just because of all the, just because of where it fit in the timeline. Like, we were trying to buy into the story that in reality, like, I could have told you how the story was going to end before I even saw episode 1.
But I mean, like, isn't that true of the prequels?
Yeah, I guess it's true of Rogue One, too.
Yeah, like, Rogue One, we know that none of those characters end up being important.
Right, right.
So, like, still worked. But they could kill all of them, though. So I think that does that leaves jeopardy for us, I would say. But, like, the prequels, we knew Obi-Wan and Anakin and Yoda were all going to survive, and Emperor Palpatine. So like all the main characters, aside from like Padme, we knew were going to make it through the prequels.
Even Boba Fett, but there's still some Jeopardy stakes there to it, because like, I mean, they like, if you care about the animated stuff, like Cad Bane is like not a small Star Wars character. And they like they yeeted him out of that they were like legitimate stakes to Boba Fett, and I think the hides of Boba Fett were better than the hides of Kenobi as well. I don't know. I'm a little low on the show. I'm a little low on just a little low on it. I don't know. The duel was great. I'll watch the duel over and over.
The duel was great. I'll watch TikTok edits of that duel over and over and over again. I will say that nothing has passed the Clone Wars yet.
You mean in terms of
that's
quality?
That's just an objective fact. Yeah. In terms of Star Wars shows, I
don't
even
agree.
The Mandalorian. You think the Mandalorian's better than Clone Wars?
I have Mandalorian.
I would strongly disagree.
And then I actually have Star Wars Visions, and then I have the Clone Wars.
Weeb.
And then Book of Boba Fett, and then Obi-Wan Kenobi.
So is Visions worth watching?
I haven't seen Rebels. I haven't not seen Rebels yet. I love Visions.
Okay, that's interesting.
There are some really phenomenal episodes. I mean, it's not a story, it's an anthology. And there's this, right. The second one is like not good, but all the other ones are various degrees of good to great.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah. So if you are a little low on Obi-Wan Kenobi, just go watch Visions instead.
Or the Clone Wars. Or the Clone Wars. Or Star Wars Rebels, which comes afterward and isn't as good as the Clone Wars, but still has good content.
Yeah, I have Rebels and Bad Batch on my watch list right now.
Yep, same.
But I'm watching Peaky Blinders instead, so.
Which is worth watching. And in a week, Stranger Things drops.
Yes.
And then we will be giving a full review of that because it is excellent.
I was going to ask, are we just going to now cover the second half of Ms. Marvel now? Or are we going to do Stranger Things? Or what is the pop culture segment? Where do we go from here?
Stranger Things. I have not touched an episode of Ms. Marvel. I mean, maybe I should, but like, I have to watch all of Peaky Blinders, and I need to finish The Clone Wars, and I need to finish Stranger Things when it comes out. So like, we're busy over here.
That's so disrespectful to a show that ran circles around Kenobi while being debuted at the same time as Kenobi.
Well, I remember I was watching Stranger Things while Kenobi was debuting.
Miss Marvel's excellent.
It is. It's actually good.
It's excellent.
I've heard good things about it.
It's not good. It's excellent.
It's excellent. Wow.
Yes.
Is it as excellent as Peaky Blinders, though?
No. No.
Okay. Okay.
There is no Star Wars or Marvel television that will come close to touching the one episode of Peaky Blinders that I've seen so far.
Chad has truly been converted, and I'm a very proud podcaster.
Well, guys, that is the podcast today. Nice and short, nice and brief. A little bit of sports, a little bit of pop culture. We'll be back next week. I think next week we're going to do a little bit longer because we're going to deep dive into the history. And after, you know, the history and the continued effect of Title IX, because it is the 50th? What anniversary is it?
I think it's the 50th anniversary.
The 50th anniversary of Title IX being enacted. And so we're going to talk about that from a sporting perspective. There's a lot of places to go with that. If you listen to the ESPN Daily podcast, they've devoted the entire week to Title IX. And actually, I haven't listened to it yet, but today they're doing one about transgender women in sports as part of that Title IX series. Check that out, and we'll be back next week. In the meantime, you know all the things you can do with the podcast, like them or rate them or review them or subscribe to them. You can interact with us on social media. And John, do you have any final thoughts for the people before we get out of here for another week?
I'm excited for Stranger Things.
What are the two things you're most excited for Stranger Things? I just picked two as a random number.
Honestly, my primary emotion is a little bit of fear. I'm excited for a potential Hopper 11 reunion because those always
are definitely a
core of the show. Yeah. I am afraid that my man Steve is going to die. That's what I'm afraid of. And I can't shake that feeling.
I've been sitting on this take for a while, and I'm going to shoot my shot. We're going to have three deaths in these two episodes.
Three deaths.
Three deaths. Jonathan's gone.
That's completely fine.
Max is gone.
That wouldn't surprise me.
And either Steve or Eddie are going to get yeeted out of here. And I love both of them. But I think one of those two are going to go. That's my prediction. I hope I'm wrong for Max's and Steve's sake. But I'm not feeling good about it.
I don't know. Yeah, it does feel like the kind of show that Max would die in. Mm-hmm. But it's also possible that Lucas would die.
I've thought about that too.
There's also a potential that Lucas would somehow like sacrifice himself for Max somehow. I can see that happening.
If nothing else, I get to listen to Running Up That Hill like 3 more times next week.
I've listened to that song so many times, bro. It's been an atrocity.
Yeah, is that next Friday?
Yeah. Okay.
So maybe not the next podcast, but the podcast after that, we'll have some Stranger Things talk. And until then, guys, we hope you all continue to be well and be safe, and we will talk to you later.
All right. Cheers, guys.